It's Wednesday, May 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, it appears a new and controversial president is elected in the Philippines.
The raid resulted in the successful recovery of Ali Khadr Jilani.
Special forces find and recover the kidnapped son of a former Pakistan prime minister. President Obama plans to visit Hiroshima. Would Donald Trump start an Asian nuclear arms race? Also ahead, country star Keith Urban makes interesting musical collaborations. It's all on today's International Edition. Although an official announcement of Monday's election results in the Philippines is still days away, unofficial results show the controversial mayor of Davao City the winner of the presidential contest. The often outspoken and profane 71-year-old Rodrigo Duterte easily won the top spot, taking in 6 million more votes than his nearest rival, former Interior Secretary Mar Rojas. He takes office in June. One of the issues high on Mr. Duterte's agenda is China's activity near the Philippines in the South China Sea. He has indicated he is prepared to negotiate with China over Manila's maritime dispute with Beijing, while also stating he favors a multilateral negotiation involving his country's allies as well as other claimants.
America, maybe Japan and Australia, want a multilateral roundtable discussion of the issue. Because it is not only the Philippines which is really claiming that piece of property there.
During the campaign, the unorthodox Mr. Duterte promised to attack the country's three biggest problems, crime, corruption, and poverty, quickly and, if necessarily, brutally. He has suggested killing criminals, including members of drug gangs, as a way to solve crime. Fred Magdalena is the associate director of the Center of Philippine Studies at the University of Hawaii. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty he doubts the apparent president-elect will rule like the country's last dictator, Ferdinand Marcos, who was finally driven from power by the so-called People's Power Uprising in 1986.
It's a different kind of strongman rule. It's something that you find in many places in the Philippines, the so-called Orang Bisar, which is a phenomenon that you also see in the Muslim world in Southeast Asia, Malaysia, Indonesia, for example. We have that equivalent in the Philippines. And of course, there are extreme forms, but I think Duterte would be a kind of strongman, would do away from the footsteps of Ferdinand Marcos.
There is some concern that the previous reformers like Gloria Arroyo and Benigno Aquino were very slow in the way they were going about reform. Is that the sense that voters wanted somebody who's going to promise to speed things up?
I think that's the sentiment of many voters, especially those from the South. They are kind of disenchanted with the way things are done, especially by the last two administrations under Arroyo and Aquino. I guess that kind of disappointment among the voters, especially among the poor and middle-class groups of people, have led them to favor Duterte over, you know, the other presidential candidates.
He's made some interesting statements. One, he favors killing criminals. Do you consider this a very controversial position that will put him at odds with allies like the United States?
Some believe that he is serious, but others think that he's just joking, you know. And although he doesn't smile whenever he cracks a joke about killing criminals, people in Davao don't really think that he really does that. Of course, there are reports about people being liquidated by the so-called Davao Death Squad, but this has not been proven to be true other than being considered an urban legend. It depends on the perception of people, but for many, I think he sounds more like a joker than a serious killer or punisher that would make good on his threat to kill criminals.
Fred Magdalena says on the international stage, Mr. Duterte will have to show a greater degree of diplomacy and listen to his advisors rather than act on his instincts. We turn now to the latest online reaction with our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, who joins me here in the studio to give us a peek on what's happening online. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
What do you have for us today?
As always, U.S. politics is a popular topic in Twitter sphere. But let's change the gear from the last 2 days and begin with the Democratic Party. Frontrunner Hillary Clinton announced a plan to cap the child care costs, and under her plan, the cost will be limited at 10% of a family's income, with federal funding and tax relief for low- and middle-class families. She posted a video about the plan on Facebook, and within 4 hours, that clip garnered more than 2,500 reactions, both positive and negative, but the top comments were critical of the lifetime politician criticizing her purported money laundering from the Clinton Foundation and paid speeches to Wall Street.
Wow. Well, what else are people talking about on the Democrat side?
Hashtag Bernie in Sacramento is a trending hashtag at this hour. He held a rally in California and said the corporate establishment is getting nervous about seeing 15,000 people gathering in Sacramento to support him.
Well, let's find out what's happening on the GOP side. What's the buzz there?
It's about a reporter who profiled Donald Trump's wife filing a police report. The Washington Post reported Julia Ioffe, who wrote the profile for GQ magazine, is receiving anti-Semitic threats to kidnap or injure her. Melania Trump has called the profile dishonest. Jim, back to you.
Thank you for the analysis, G. You know, we're all over social media. You can follow us on Facebook. Visit us there at VOA Now. And you may follow G on Twitter at G Abby Lee and myself at VOA Stevenson. We also invite you to follow the International Edition Twitter stream. That's found at VOA underscore IE. Here are some of the top stories that are trending right now in Asia. Trump's rise could legitimize nuclear hawks in Asia. Suicide bombing kills 10 in Afghan region near Pakistan. Islamic State radio broadcasts reemerge in Afghanistan. Pakistani clerics issue fatwa against Islamic State. Climbers near Everest summit for the first time in 3 years. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at our voanews.com website, also on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. U.S. and Afghan commandos in a joint raid Tuesday rescued the son of a former Pakistani prime minister after 3 years of captivity from an al-Qaeda-affiliated group. U.S. State Department Press Office Director Elizabeth Trudeau commenting Tuesday in Washington on the raid.
U.S. Special Operation Forces partnered with Afghan National Defense and Security Forces today in a counterterrorism operation in Patika Province, Afghanistan. The raid resulted in the successful recovery of Ali Hadar Jilani, the son of Pakistan's former Prime Minister Yusuf Raza Jilani, who had been held hostage since May 2013. Senior officials have been in contact with Afghan and Pakistani authorities on the operation, as well as on the repatriation of Mr. Jilani.
Unknown gunmen kidnapped Ali Hadar Jilani from a 2013 election rally in his native southern city of Multan, and his whereabouts were not known until now. Again, the State Department's Elizabeth Trudeau.
This raid demonstrates the growing capabilities and effectiveness of the Afghan security forces and is an excellent example of the strong security and intelligence partnership between Afghan and U.S. forces in counterterrorism operations against the remnants of al-Qaeda. Working alongside our Afghan partners, we'll continue to make clear there's no safe haven for terrorists in Afghanistan.
Yusuf Raza Jilani was Prime Minister of Pakistan from March 2008 until April 2012. His kidnapped son had made contact with the family about a year ago to tell him that he was well. Meanwhile, Kabul's ambassador to Islamabad, Hazrat Omer Zakhilwal, says that he called the former Pakistani Prime Minister and informed him about the good news. The recovery occurs at a time of increased bilateral tensions stemming from allegations that Pakistan has not ended its covert support to the Taliban-led insurgency in Afghanistan. The relationship deteriorated further last month after an April 19th suicide bombing in Kabul that Afghan authorities blamed on the Al-Qaeda-linked Haqqani network, allegedly operating from Pakistan. Islamabad has denied the charges, saying it had nothing to do with the attack, in which about 70 people were killed and hundreds more wounded. U.S. President Barack Obama will visit Hiroshima this month when he travels to Japan for the G7 summit. Obama would likely use the visit to focus the world's attention on the growing threat of North Korea's nuclear program, which is expected to be among the items on the G7 agenda. Hiroshima survivors hope he will, while perhaps not apologizing, at least acknowledge the devastating loss and suffering caused by America's use of nuclear weapons on Japan at the end of World War II. On August 6, 1945, the United States dropped the world's first atomic bomb on Hiroshima, killing around 140,000 people, including those that died later from intense radiation exposure. Today, the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park, located at the epicenter of the blast, commemorates those who suffered and died. Some who lived through this nuclear ordeal, like 79-year-old Keiko Ogura, want President Obama to come there to recognize the catastrophic consequences of using nuclear weapons.
Before I die, I want to see the president, the sitting president face. That is not for asking for apology. No. Just as a human being, you are here, and that we are standing on the same land, the same level land, and then pray for the dead.
Ogura was just 8 years old at the time, and she said she was 2.5 kilometers away from the epicenter and was still knocked to the ground by the force of the explosion.
When I came to myself, everywhere was just dark, couldn't see anything, and quiet.
From the perspective of the victors, the atomic bomb saved the lives of many American troops by bringing an early end to the war. But they also killed thousands of innocent civilians, and many victims died in the months and years later from different forms of cancer caused by radiation exposure. Japanese survivors have told VOA they hope an Obama visit to Hiroshima will not revive the debate over the U.S. wartime decision to drop the bomb, but will help bolster an international commitment to abolish all nuclear weapons in the future. Conservative advocates of providing nuclear weapons to America's closest Asian military allies could move from the political fringes to the mainstream. That is, if Donald Trump becomes the next president of the United States. VOA's Brian Padden reports from Seoul that comments made by the presumptive Republican Party nominee about disengaging from Asia have raised doubts about the U.S. commitment to the region's security and strengthened the argument of those who say regional allies should have nuclear weapons to protect themselves.
Mr. Donald J. Trump.
During the campaign for the U.S. presidency, Republican candidate Donald Trump has suggested allowing Japan and South Korea to arm themselves with nuclear weapons and withdrawing troops from countries that do not agree to pay more for the U.S. military bases in their countries. There are currently 28,500 U.S. troops stationed in South Korea and 54,000 in Japan. Tokyo reportedly pays about $1.6 billion, and Seoul pays over $866 million annually to Washington for the military bases in their countries. Some experts say Trump's willingness to consider giving allies nuclear weapons, if enacted, would violate the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
If the U.S. allies defend themselves, as Trump has said, the alliance will be broken, and it will lead to a nuclear domino situation in Asia.
Despite concerns that began when China became a nuclear power, or more recently over North Korea's rogue nuclear program, Washington has been able to persuade or pressure its Asian allies to depend on its nuclear umbrella for protection. However, Trump's threat to pull out of Asia could strengthen minority voices in Japan's parliament and South Korea's National Assembly, who say they can no longer depend on the United States for protection.
If Trump's statements become a reality, there'll be politicians that will agree and a lot will be enthusiastic, I believe.
Arming South Korea and Japan with nuclear weapons would likely increase regional tensions, legitimize North Korea's nuclear program, and end any support from China and Russia for international sanctions against the Kim Jong-un government.
Make America great again. Thank you.
Even though Trump is just a candidate and not yet president, his words are resonating in Asia, and many believe his message, whether intended or not, could undermine confidence in America's commitment to the region. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
And there's some great video to watch with this story. You can see it at our website, voanews.com, or by using the VOA app if you have a smartphone. Well, some good news on the Zika virus front. A team of researchers based at Harvard University say they have developed a testing method that could quickly diagnose Zika virus and do basically that anywhere in the world. The Zika outbreak first hit the Western Hemisphere about a year ago with reports of infections in Brazil. Some 57 countries and territories are now reporting cases of people being infected, mostly by mosquito bites that can carry the Zika virus. Most of the affected countries are in Latin America and the Caribbean, and the World Health Organization says if the pattern spreads elsewhere, the world faces a severe public health crisis. Building on the work they did to develop a screening method for Ebola, the researchers came up with a way to screen blood, urine, or saliva to detect the Zika virus. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Multiple Grammy winner Keith Urban has released his eighth studio album. It's titled Ripcord. And the current single off that album, Wasted Time, has already reached number 16 on the Billboard country charts. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the new album features Urban collaborating with rapper Pitbull and funk guitarist Nile Rodgers.
Listening to Keith Urban's new single, Wasted Time, it isn't obvious that the song came out of a profound loss. Urban was in the midst of putting together songs for his new album, Ripcord, when his father, Robert, died in December. Keith and co-producer Greg Wells were working in Wells' California studio with pop songwriter James J. Hart Abrahart when the song came together. Urban used imagery from his childhood and his high school years to form the lyrics. Urban also got help on Ripcord from rapper Pitbull, who is featured on the cut Son Don't Let Me Down. The country singer and guitarist said the groove for the song was missing something, and Pitbull had just the right ingredient.
His delivery, and it's probably the Cuban thing, puts him in a different rhythmic place than a lot of other people. So I just thought, man, I've always loved that guy. And instantly, at the same time, I thought, he would be killer on that song. And thematically was part of it, too. You know, lyrically, it was the right song for him. I thought, it's got the energy, it's funky, it's lyrically right.
Keith Urban also got some help from funk guitarist and Chic co-founder Nile Rodgers, who has also worked with Daft Punk, Pharrell Williams, Madonna, and David Bowie. Urban, himself an accomplished guitarist, says he had to prove to Nile Rodgers that his six-string banjo, called a ganjo, worked on the album.
and he'd play his thing, and I'd grab my six-string banjo and just started playing along, and it was immediate for me that these three things went together, this super programmed rhythm thing, him playing the Nile Mojo thing he does, and the six-string banjo all working together really, really well, and very organically too. Nothing felt forced, it all felt fluid.
Urban said he felt free to create working with Pitbull and Nile Rodgers, even though the CD didn't really fit the traditional idea of country music. Keith says that Rodgers and others don't have any limits when it comes to creating.
They just create. And Nile is all about the feel and the vibe and just going. And keep going until you're in the zone. If you're in the zone, then you're in the zone. If you're not in the zone, keep looking for it. Keep playing and searching towards it and playing towards it, you know. So I think all of that stuff, working with a lot of these guys, I found very artistically and creatively liberating.
Keith Urban's Ripcord has already produced two number one singles, John Cougar, John Deere, John 316, and Break on Me. Keith Urban will tour North America in the summer months and then plans to take the Ripcord tour home to Australia in December. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Time for us to pull the ripcord on this edition of International Edition. You can find us anytime you like at our website, voanews.com. Like us on Facebook, VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. Jimmy Cook was our engineer. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us today, and we hope you have a wonderful day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the United States marks May 11th as Vietnam Human Rights Day to highlight our nation's support for promoting and protecting basic freedoms in that Southeast Asian nation. The U.S. and Vietnam recently concluded their 20th annual Human Rights Dialogue in Washington. The meeting covered a wide range of human rights issues this year, including the importance of continued progress on legal reform efforts, rule of law, freedom of expression and assembly, religious freedom, labor rights, disability rights, LGBTI rights, multilateral cooperation, as well as individual cases of concern. U.S. Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Tom Malinowski, told the press that over the last year, there was a continued overall decline in arrests and convictions for those peacefully expressing their religious and political views in Vietnam. However, Assistant Secretary Malinowski expressed concern about the recent uptick in convictions for peaceful dissent. He said the United States expressed our hope that this would be addressed and that some of the long-standing cases of concern would be resolved. Among the individual cases raised by the United States was Nguyen Van Dai, a prominent human rights lawyer who was arrested in December on charges of spreading anti-state propaganda. In 2007, Dai was sentenced to 4 years on a similar charge. Another high-profile case is that of blogger Nguyen Hu Vinh, who was sentenced to 5 years in prison in March for what authorities called abusing rights to freedom and democracy to infringe upon the interests of the state. During the last week in March, Vietnam convicted a total of 7 activists. According to the latest State Department Human Rights report at the end of 2015, Vietnam still held around 100 political prisoners. The United States continues to call for the unconditional release of all prisoners of conscience. Assistant Secretary Malinowski noted that the United States also continues to follow Vietnam's progress on legal reform necessary to bring Vietnamese laws in step with Vietnam's own constitution and international commitments. Vietnam's National Assembly is due this year to take up key laws, including the law on association, law on demonstrations, and law on religion, all of which could have a profound impact on human rights. Concern for the basic human rights of the Vietnamese people remains an integral part of the U.S.-Vietnam relationship.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.